Welcome, listeners, to another episode of The Pursuit of Perfectness. I'm with my co-host, Dennis Pacheco.
Hi, that's the voice you heard first is Ellen Matthews. That's my co-host, and boy, oh boy, I just love that theme music.
I love it so much. I like it more and more every episode, to be honest.
Our guest today has a personal connection to our theme music composer. We're not going to say anything more than that right now. That's the tease. We baited the hook, and now you got to eat the bait, I guess. Isn't that a metaphor? Mm-hmm. Ellen, keep talking.
Well, this is The Pursuit of Perfectness, as you know, the podcast where we ask ourselves, why are we like this? Are you like this too? What can we do about it? It's a podcast for self-proclaimed perfectionists and exploring how perfectionism affects us in our lives, in the way we create, in the way we relate to people. And I gotta say, we always have very insightful conversations, and I walk away with some beautiful jewels of wisdom.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, Dennis.
Yeah, every time I walk away with some beautiful jewels of wisdom.
Yeah.
I think every single guest we've had has just knocked it right out of the park. I think we're going to keep that sweep going today. I'd be stunned if we didn't. our guest today is going to talk about mental health and art, and how perfection and perfectionism manifests in mental health and in their work. And how art school glorifies it and pushes it in a bad way. That sounds awesome. I went to art school. In fact, I went to the same art school, but we're just teasing that. We're not saying any more than that.
Is it a coincidence, or are we reaching out to people within our network? Who's to say?
Who can say? Well, you'll find out.
Who can say? You'll find out. Dennis, why don't we do the old, how was your week?
Oh, gosh, I didn't prepare anything for this. I think my week was good overall. I'm still... Last time, I talked about how I feel like I'm kind of in a rut. And that is how my perfectionism manifests itself is, it's like it's got to be, you know, to quote Spud from Trainspotting, it's got to be the best or it's nothing at all. Right? It's all or nothing. Often I'll do some work or whatever that's like, that I'm very happy with. But sometimes I'll stumble and then I'll just be a wreck and it'll affect every piece of my life like dominoes. It's like, well, if I'm not doing this, then I'm not going to do that. And everything is terrible. It's not quite depression. It is a lot of anxiety. So my week, I continued along that path a little bit, but it got better. I think it's getting better. I talked to my therapist today. Didn't have therapy last week, so that probably is why. Well, not probably why, but that I'm sure didn't help my mood last week. This week I had therapy. My therapist, Lisa, is amazing, and it's very like. It's cognitive behavioral therapy, so it's a lot of like, well, you can do this. We've learned these skills, and now you can apply them in this way, and blah blah blah. And then it's like, oh yeah, I can do this. I can do this.
Love that. I gotta ask Dennis. Yeah. You brushing your teeth at night?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I felt like a monster the last time we talked because I said that like for a few nights in a row, I didn't brush my teeth, floss, or rinse with mouthwash. But I woke up.
Sometimes it happens. Sometimes you're so overwhelmed with the day that you're like, I can't do one other thing. But I will say, Dennis, I brushed my teeth every night last week. And every time I felt like I was doing something amazing. Because we had that conversation. And I was like, I'm doing something that's, you know, not always easy to do when you're overwhelmed.
But here's the thing. I have good teeth. I just want to get this out of the way. My dentist compliments me. And here's the thing I didn't admit. This is me being vulnerable.
Lay it on us.
Never used to brush my teeth at night. Until like this decade.
Okay, this is why you were so afraid to admit that. Because I'm like, well, we've all forgotten to brush our teeth or been too lazy. But if this is like, if this used to be a chronic pattern, now I can see why you felt so vulnerable. Well,
it's just
about
it. It's just a habit that I never formed.
Wow. So, and did you get cavities?
Like the normal amount of cavities. Not many. Like, I have great teeth. I really do.
There's no normal amount of cavities. You're not supposed to get cavities.
I don't know, 40, 50 cavities. Like the normal amount.
You know, the normal amount.
Yeah.
No.
I got a stray cavity now and then as a kid. But the thing is, when I brushed my teeth in the morning, I brushed like a fucking demon.
But you're not like you're going to make up for it. It's not like, that's your strategy? Brush till you bleed
this
in the morning.
You're having a conversation with a dead person because I'm not that person anymore. So this is fruitless.
Okay, you're right. You've grown. I'm preaching to the choir. You're brushing twice a day.
Yeah, this all happened and because of the Medicaid expansion in New York. I got health insurance. I got so I was able to see a therapist. I was able to go to the dentist and stuff. Once I started,
you were spiraling up. You were spiraling up.
Yeah, that famous expression.
I love that for you. I love that for you.
Yeah, and then I just wanted to impress my dentist.
I get it. I feel the same way. Yeah. Well, that sounds like a hell of a week, Dennis. My week was good. I drank some alcohol this weekend. Should I give a trigger warning for talking about mention of alcohol? I don't know, because it was like anxiety about alcohol. So you know what? Let's put that out there. Mention of anxiety around alcohol. That could be a trigger for people. So I drank on Friday night and had a fantastic time. but on Saturday, I had a hangover, and I do what I always do, which is I'm like, ugh, I had more than I thought I was going to do, and now I have a hangover, and now my whole next day is ruined, and it's a beautiful day outside, and now you're wasting the day, and maybe you should have had more water in between, and I just go back, and it's almost as if I think I can drink in a perfect way, right? Like, if you drink, there are going to be consequences, no matter how you slice it. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, no, I could have, like a chemist, I could have found the perfect combination to reduce the hangover, to, you know, that I can wake up and still have the day. And so I do this a lot where, like, I drink and I get a hangover. Like, nothing wrong with that. That's part of it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, didn't do anything irresponsible, you know, didn't drive, didn't throw anything, you know, it was just like a fun night. But of course I'm going to beat myself up about something, yeah, right? Yeah. So that's where my perfectionism has been manifesting that week, thinking that I can drink in a perfect way to avoid any consequence the following day.
Yeah, because it's all about control, right?
Yes.
And it's about beating yourself up. For not always being in control. And that's the thing we're working on here.
That's right. Beautiful.
Yeah.
I think, I feel like we need a third voice in this conversation.
Well, have I got you covered, Alan? It's time to introduce our guest. Our guest
She's
today
been
Jenny.
Waiting in the green room.
She's been waiting in the green room, cooling her heels. I think we got somebody doing manicures in there now. Doing hot towels around the head. We'll find out.
Big budget on pursuit of perfectness.
Okay, well, we have to start over. Anyway,
welcome, listeners. Sorry, okay. Go ahead.
Oh, man, it is my absolute pleasure to introduce our guest today. She is a motion graphics designer and a storyteller in all kinds of media. Welcome, please, Jenny B. Jenny B! Yeah, applause.
Did you know that there's, like, a whole bunch of stuff back there in that green room? And there's, like, a little door. Like, it's really little, though. Like, I could only get my head through. Like, my shoulders got stuck. It was, I mean, but there's, like, a really cool shit on the other side of the door.
Oh, yeah?
You should probably get it looked at.
I've never looked. We call it the Malkovich door. We assume it leads into the mind of John Malkovich.
You know, that actually makes a lot more sense now that you told me that.
So you stuck your head in and you saw a bunch of John Malkoviches? Is that what happened?
Yes, actually. Okay.
Well, there you go. It's confirmed.
All right. Confirmed. Thank you for that.
Jenny, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for joining us. We are so excited to talk to you today about perfectionism as it manifests in mental health and art. I can't wait to talk about this. This sounds really fascinating. I'm really excited to talk to you about this subject. And Dennis, it's a personal connection for you because you went to art school, so I'm sure you can relate to this on a personal level.
That's right.
Same art school.
We went to the same art school at different times, though.
Yes.
We didn't. We don't know.
Oh, so you did not cross paths at all?
Never crossed
paths. Oh.
No. Do you want to tell that story, Jenny, of how we met?
Of how we met? Yeah,
because I think it's fun.
It is fun. I was making my thesis film in that same art school, the School of Visual Arts, and I needed someone to play an art teacher, a scary art teacher, and I just started going to the Magnet Theater because my mentor at the time, I think she, in some capacity, had like ownership stake or something. I don't know. I don't remember. It's complicated. she was involved in some capacity at the Magnet Theater. She is also wonderful, and I miss her very much. She's not dead. She's just somewhere else. but anyway, she was like, go, you know, sit at shows, find people, and then reach out. And I did. And it didn't work out a lot. But I reached out to Dennis, and that worked out really well. And we met, I think, at Magnet, right? Was it Magnet or SBA? I always confuse these details.
Where? I don't know. I guess it might have been. It's probably Magnet.
It was probably Magnet. Because at Magnet, you told me that you had gone to SBA for cartooning, and I was like, that's perfect. You remember, like, all, you know, like, what haughty art teachers are like. That's exactly what I need.
Yeah, I had a lot of good luck with teachers, but I had a couple of duds.
They run the gamut.
No, just kidding. What'd you say, Jay?
Oh, I said they run the gamut.
Yeah, they really run the gamut. So let's get into it. So, well, first of all, I just want to mention, you've got a personal connection to our theme song writer, Keith Bergen. Is that correct?
That is correct. He is my fiancé. I thought I was going to come up with a clever way to say that, but then the words came out of my mouth completely normal.
It's already such a fancy word. It's really hard to jazz it up more. Fiancé, you know? It's so great on its own.
It's like when they don't let you add salt, you know, to the food. Like, they don't put the salt shakers on the table. That's like what they did with the word fiancé.
That's,
they're like, it's already fancy.
That's a perfect analogy. Mm-hmm. That's a perfect analogy.
Well, I just wanted to mention that because I think it's fun.
It's very cool.
Like, we like Keith a lot.
It's a huge coincidence.
World is colliding. It's one world, but it's colliding. Let's get into it. So, would you describe yourself as a perfectionist, Jenny?
That's interesting. Because when you reached out to me about this podcast, my reaction was, I'm so flattered that you think I'm a perfectionist because I feel like I'm not good enough to be a perfectionist. Because, like, that's the thing, isn't it? Like, you don't
know,
like, you're good enough ever to be a perfectionist. So you're like, I'm not a real perfectionist.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, that's a very humble response, but Dennis and I usually say on this podcast, we're perfectionists. And by the way, it's not a compliment.
It's not a good thing.
It's not a good
also
thing.
I know you have, you've got high standards and you're very creative, in your work, your high standards and your sense of humor and intelligence come through. But the reason I thought you were going to say was like, I'm not a perfectionist is because you actually get things done.
Mm.
Like you have projects that get done, which is like a skill that I think is not in line with what we think of as perfectionism.
Yes.
But, you know, maybe you have some tendencies here and there to, like, beat yourself up over something not being absolutely perfect.
Yeah. I think that I learned at some point, I don't know when, someone once said these words to me, and I think they're very true, that perfect is the enemy of done.
Yes.
And so, I don't know when, like, I agree with these words a lot, and I think you know, before I had the words to put to them, I very much practiced this of like, it's got to be done at some point. Like in high school, I definitely didn't know this as much. And I super would like crash and burn a lot. I would go in and like mess with my work way past when it should be like finished. And I would overwork things. And I had a really bad tendency to do that. But yeah, I think I'm flattered because, yes, I do have a tendency to get things done because I think in my case of, like, my own brain and mental illness and things, I'm going to be a person who gets things done. Otherwise, I would crumble like a souffle.
Yeah, I think I love that spin on the because the old adage that we all know and love is perfect as the enemy of the good, but the spin on it is perfect as the enemy of done. I like that a lot. It kind of thuds at the end in a fun way. Or it's like a door slamming shut. It's true. Like, you just gotta finish stuff, man. I think that's why I like improv, because there's no homework.
Same.
Overwork something.
Same. I started in sketch writing, and couldn't stop editing my sketches. And with improv, Jenny, do you do improv as well?
Oh, God, no.
Improv is for children.
No. Jenny, I knew what you meant right away. It came from a humble place. I understood. Dennis, don't put a cruel spin on what Jenny, our wonderful guest, said.
No, I was trying to out-humble.
That's true, actually. What I was going to say about improv is, like, I've definitely had a show where, you know, the next day I'll be in the shower thinking and I'll be like, oh, I should have said this. Oh, I should have done this. Oh, whatever. And I'm like, well, good thing I don't have the chance to do it because, you know, like it's done, right? It doesn't matter. Yeah. Like you have these thoughts now, but like, you know what? I'm glad you don't have this opportunity because then you would just be rewinding. Like you made your first choice and it's done and it's fine. So I agree. Yeah. I agree, Dennis. I like that there's a limited time for you to make choices.
And you can't overwork it.
Right.
And that's why improv feels so alive, I think. But yeah, sketch always stressed me out. I'd edit and edit a lot, but also it just stressed me out. Like I'd procrastinate on writing scripts and stuff. But
I was just going to say, I'd love to talk about stress and would love to hear your experience in art school. Was that a very stressful time? Was it a very happy time? I'm guessing by that laugh that it was a stressful time.
Okay. All right. I think a lot about this podcast I listened to once. Don't remember it at all. Don't remember which podcast it was. Sorry, whatever podcast. It might have been a TED Talk, actually. Now that I think about it, it probably was a TED Talk. Mm-hmm. Don't remember who. Sorry, person whose TED Talk it was.
But the message resonated with you, and that's what matters.
The message resonated. And the TED Talk basically said that they found that stress only hurts you if you believe it is bad for your health.
I've seen this TED Talk. Yes.
Yes. And that if you don't view it as bad for your health, it actually can be kind of good for your health.
Yes.
And I watched this TED Talk like years and years and years ago, and it's just always stuck with me. And when I find myself getting freaked out and stressed out, I try to take it in stride and I try to view it as that.
I love
and
that.
So I'm prefacing all these art school things with that in mind. Because I was super happy, loved it. I love to be busy. It's my favorite thing. I was incredibly happy as I was burning myself to the ground physically and like emotionally and mentally and socially. Honestly, spiritually, maybe like literally every aspect a person could be burnt down. Yeah. I was burnt down and I was doing it to myself and I was doing it super happily because I just was happy to be there. But also because the institutions expect it from you, and they push you to do it, and they reward you for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a massive problem. It's why we have art students sleeping, like undergrads sleeping in computer labs.
Oh my goodness.
I slept at my school building as a grad student. I slept there multiple times, if I slept at all. I wasn't eating. I was like, it was pretty messed up. And like, I remember my first semester at grad school, I broke out into stress hives over my hands.
Oh my gosh.
And I was just like, what is happening? And it was, yeah, that was just my life. And it was pretty brutal. But I assume you have more questions, so I'm going to stop talking.
Wow. Dennis, was that what it was like for you?
I don't think I had it that bad. I mean, I loved it. I loved every second of it. But also, I would stress myself out. I would sleep. Yeah, I remember staying up, you know, sleep, having all night, pulling all-nighters. And it was rough. And the thing about comics is, like, comics takes... It's hard. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of time. And it's just, like, what they expect you to do is kind of, like, how do you even do it? Like, my final project, a comic book in junior year, I don't think I quite finished it until, like, after I'd graduated and went back to it, because I just didn't have time. I didn't have time.
You know, it sounds similar to like a residency program, you know, like when you think of physicians sleeping at the hospital, like it just, that's the vibe I'm getting from your experiences. Was it that like the deadlines were just insane? They were like, you have to have this complete by tomorrow. And it was just unrealistic deadlines?
I think it was a few different things. I think first and foremost, it's the atmosphere. I think the environment expects this of you. And because it expects this of you, you do it and you're happy to do it. Because you want to do the thing that is expected of you. And you want to be good and you want to get praised and you want to like work really hard. But I also think it's, yeah, there are ridiculous deadlines. It's absurd. And it actually kind of ties into perfectionism as well. And similar to what you were saying about sketch, the notion of when to stop listening to feedback is a real problem. My first stint in grad school, we had to do this project, which is no longer done. I'm thankful to report. They don't do this project anymore. We were one of the last classes that were subjected to
it. Oh, wow.
Basically, we had to create in 1 month, allegedly 1 month, we had to create a timed piece of about 5 minutes, and it had to have a performative element to it, and the whole time you were doing it, it had to, like, we were being critiqued, essentially. So we would... think we had our story on lock, but then we would have to redo our entire story. and then we would think we had it solved again, and then we would have to redo our entire story. And so basically, I was working and reworking my story up until, like, pretty much the last week, because I continuously listened to the feedback that I was getting.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a pretty severe lesson for me, because that last week, I maybe slept, like, 2 hours. I know one guy didn't sleep for 5 days. I thought that could kill you, but he made it. And then he did a rap for everybody. It was amazing. I remember I had my piece, like the last one to go or something, or was second to last. And I remember sitting in Starbucks with my fiancé, who wrote the theme song, Keith, and sitting there, like, I had to go perform a fucking song with my 5-minute animated piece that was between an animatic and an animation that I had made in, like, less than, like, 2 weeks, probably. And just feeling... I remember thinking that I felt like the color red.
Oh, like, interesting.
That was all that I could think of. I was like, I feel like red.
Wow.
And I have never felt this horrible in my life.
Yeah.
And now I have to go sing a song.
Right. It almost seems like hazing in a way.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, we're going to haze you. And then when you're done, it's like you've come out of this thing that's intentionally difficult and unpleasant for the sake of being difficult and unpleasant, right? It's like an initiation of sorts. And it's interesting to hear you say, like, it's really the culture, right? It's like, yes, it's the deadlines, but it's more so the power of this is expected of you and you don't want to be the only one who doesn't do it. I mean, this feels similar to corporate life as well, right? Like, who can work the longest hours, you know? Who can prove that they're the most valuable? And it's like, if you're the one person that says, hey, I'm going to go home and eat dinner, you know, you don't want to be seen as the slacker.
Yeah, they start you young.
Yeah.
They start it in school. And that's, yeah, I 100%, I had a weird backwards falling into the culture of, in my foundation year, it was exactly the same. It was horrible. It was brutal. It was like boot camp. It was one of the hardest foundation programs in the country. I transferred. And then when I was in my new program, I was like, I'm going to, like, take care of myself a little bit more, but was kind of looked down on for that. So then I started to kind of fall back into this pattern of, like, taking care of myself less. And then I was out in the real world and I was at internships and I was like, I'm going home. Like, I don't live here in the city. I have to, like, commute. I'm going to go home.
Right.
And then I would be looked over for, like, jobs and things in those same companies. So I, you know, learned pretty quick, like, oh, I got to, like, really push myself. I'm like, there's something wrong with me. I've got to be the one to, like, put in all this extra effort. So then when I got into grad school, I was so happy. I was like, I can't waste my chance here. Right. I got to put in everything.
Right.
I can't fuck it up. And then I did. And it like, really fucked me up physically, again, emotionally, mentally, in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. I'm sorry to hear that you had that experience. Do you feel like you have a better balance today, like with your work and your pieces?
Better balance today. Yeah, I think I've found a much better balance for a few reasons, in that I've been diagnosed since art school. I have ADHD, and understanding that has really helped me kind of, like, you know, have just this crystallizing moment of just seeing my entire life in the retrospect and being like, oh that's why I fall for these things so easily. Oh no. And, like, you know, I would be very hard on myself because I'm not organized. I'm not neat. I'm messy. It's hard for me to measure things. It's hard for me to, like, I impulsively cut when you're supposed to measure twice, cut once. I always cut the first time. Sorry, everyone who doesn't do that. It's just the way I am. But it's, you know, like, realizing that I had ADHD and, like, it was like kind of a huge wake-up call because, mm-hmm. again, it's why I was so susceptible to these things. It's why I was hating on myself so much because I was like different from other people in mm-hmm. this culture. And I felt like I had to work twice as hard mm-hmm. because I didn't have these like natural inclinations towards neatness and, you know, I felt like I wasn't good at it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people made me feel like I wasn't good at it mm-hmm. and that I had to try harder, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also have a late diagnosis of ADHD.
Same.
After a life, this is what it was like for me my whole life. It's just like, something is wrong with me. There's something wrong with me. I have some kind of problem, mental problem that needs to be diagnosed, but I don't know what it is. And so I can't fix it because I don't know what it is. And then eventually I was like, well, maybe it's this. And I talked to a psychiatrist and he's like, yeah, you know, and I got medication. But it's very frustrating to just know that not necessarily there's something wrong with you. Cause I don't want to say like, if you're not like a neurotypical person, that there's something wrong with you. But I was like, I have a condition, but I don't know what it is. You know what I mean? Very.
Well, yeah. You take it as personal failings.
Yeah. I'm a failure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're like, well, why am I not neat? Why do I cut, you know, when I'm not supposed to cut? Like, why am I not measuring this properly? Why does it feel like torture to measure something? Why does it feel like I'm having my skin peeled off
yeah.
to like do these things? Mm. Why is it so hard for me to clean up my house? Why can't I keep my room neat? You talked about the toothbrushing thing before. That's an ADHD thing. That's executive dysfunction. That's like, it's everywhere. It's like, wow. But you feel bad about these things, but actually it's because they're a symptom. It's like pretty significant.
Yeah.
That's so fascinating. Thank you for naming that connection, because I didn't even think about that. But yeah, that makes complete sense. Wow.
There's certain things where my attention span is just not there for it, and it makes my skin itch, and it makes me want to rip my face off. Certain things.
Oh, yeah.
And like, I'm just going to admit this again, since I'm being... this is a place where we can be vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Reading nonfiction is really, really hard for me.
Fucking impossible. I yeah. hate it. I can't do it. Hate it. That's all Keith reads, but I'm like, nope.
Yeah. Sometimes I can. If it's like I can read a newspaper article or something, or maybe if it's like a fascinating book.
It's like this.
There's like a handful of that, of those I've read. A handful. But like, I really... I have to read. I read the same sentence 50 times, and I can't.
And you find that doesn't happen when you read fiction, only nonfiction.
Just nonfiction.
Interesting. Yeah. I wonder. Any idea why?
No.
For me, it's like all I care about is story. That's like my hyperfixation. Mm. So it's like if it's kind of narrative, the nonfiction, I can do it.
Yes.
But if it's not at all, like, I can't, and have
yeah.
tried,
yeah.
and it's really hard. Yeah.
You know, you just reminded me of, I think I saw this. I love that we have all this, like, information in our brain, and we're like, I think it was a TED Talk. I think this was on, a show called Vox Explained, uh-huh. and the episode was about people who are in memorization contests. Like, there was this woman who won because she could memorize like an insane sequence of numbers. Like, she would just be like 8, 4, 2, 3, and she would just name all the numbers like to an insane degree. And the way she could do this, because humans aren't computers, they can't just remember that. What she would do is she would turn each number into a letter, and she would create a story. Mm-hmm. And then she would translate it and remember the story, because you can memorize a story. I mean, we all remember song lyrics that are in a narrative mm-hmm. form, and you add music to it, it's even more stuck in your head. And so she'd remember the story, and then she would just transcribe it back to numbers. anyway, I bring that up because it's such a cool fun fact, but also it, you know, that's such a human thing to be able to attain information through narrative, right? That's what humans do. We can't just retain facts, brute facts, without a narrative structure.
Yeah, I think narrative is probably the number one thing that defines us as human, is being able to make those narrative connections and tell stories. I used to be able to memorize like a lot of things when I was a kid, because I would visualize, like, I don't remember now, but I would visualize. There's like some kind of like visual device where I've memorized all the state capitals, and it had to do with, I don't know, it was all pictures, like this guy kicks this thing and then it falls over and then this thing happens.
Yeah, that's like a mind palace. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, like, Jenny, we're both like, I don't know if this is an ADHD thing, but we're both very visual.
I have the same thing. If it's narrative, I can remember it. That's usually how I remember things, is making it into a narrative.
Mm-hmm. This is really interesting. Should we take a quick break? Because that was such a beautiful jewel of wisdom.
Yeah, man, oh man. All right, let's take a break.
And we're back.
We're back.
We're back.
We made it.
Welcome back.
Oh, no.
Oh, goodness.
Sorry, I coughed.
Couldn't have done it during the break.
Oh, my God.
He was saving it.
That was so cruel and judgmental.
Oh, I was just joking with you, because you're my friend, and friends can joke. We're friends. Friends can joke.
France can joke. Listen, that reminds me.
What does that remind you of?
That puts me in mind of something else I wanted to talk to Jenny about, which is Dungeons & Dragons. If that's okay with you, Jenny.
Yeah. I love Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah, both of them.
The same amount.
This is a thing that I've gotten into recently since the pandemic started. I'm into D&D games, and the wonderful dungeon master for both of those is Jenny.
Wow. So many talents.
Yeah, and your stories are very like humane. They're all about like empathy and understanding. They're really like carefully thought out specific worlds. And it's a really fun space to play in. Where you're rewarded for you know, playing your character to the top of your intelligence, I guess, to use an improv term. So thanks for that. So how do you go about like creating a world? And I know this like perfect as an anime have done thing comes up, because I know from you telling us that sometimes you don't write the thing until like the day of, and then you're just like, well, that's what we're going with.
And I love this. And just for listeners who may not be familiar with Dungeons & Dragons, what could you just tell us a little bit about what it is, how it's done, and then... Because I'm new to it.
Sure. Hold on. I'm going to hurl my phone across the room so it doesn't get picked up by the mic. Wow. Literally hurled it just now.
Love it.
So, amazing. Yeah, well, firstly, I want to say thank you, Dennis, for saying such sweet and wonderful things. It means very much to me. My stories are like my children, I say, in only a little bit of a creepy way. So Dungeons & Dragons is a tabletop role-playing game. It was invented, I think, in the 80s, don't quote me on that, by Gary Gygax, I want to say. But basically, the things you need to know are, it's just, you know, someone is the master, the dungeon master, game master, tabletop, etc., and they run the game. So basically, they are the characters, and they are, like, most of the NPC that's non-player characters, and they write the story. Usually... a lot of DMs use modules that are pre-created, so that's like pre-written stories with pre-written characters. But I am just way too... like, you know when something is easier to do, but it's like, I would have to learn to do that thing.
Yes.
So I'm just going to do something much harder in the line.
I do that every day.
That's exactly what I did. So I've been just writing all these stories on my own because I was like, yeah, we should like play D&D like one time. And so we played D&D one time and then that became, but like, can we do it again? And so we've just been doing it ever since. But yeah, everyone else at the table plays their own player characters. So they're responsible for being the characters that are like the main characters of this story. I don't remember the original question.
No problem.
What is D&D? So if you've seen Stranger Things, that thing they do, that's D&D.
And what was your specific question about, Dennis, about, I believe it was, how do you come up with your stories? They're very empathetic leaning.
What's your philosophy behind narrative? And then, like, I guess you can use D&D as a vehicle for that.
Absolutely. Oh, it's going to be weird. Okay.
Why?
All right. So the way I come up with stories usually is this way, where I think about a thing that is either bothering me or is something I want to say because I just like am feeling like I'll go through a bunch of different things. Like I'll be like actually, you know what, this is really helpful. I have a notebook with me. This is helpful, and hopefully we'll make a horrible noise.
Looking for the notebook.
This is the part of the podcast where we look for the notebook. Look for the notebook. Look for the notebook.
Thank you for joining me on that, actually. I feel very... This is really a safe place.
We can't fucking help it. We're improvisers. Yes, and.
It's amazing. Okay, so for example, I did this one shot. Actually, let me use one from your campaign, Dennis, because I think that that's easier.
Yeah.
So, because then you'll understand the context. So, like, for example, the episode with... The episode we just did with... Mm-hmm. The Bones Man, whose name is cool, but I don't remember. They're going through a bureaucracy in hell. They just went through hell, and now they're going to the Underworld Postal Service to reboot their friend, who's basically a robot, more or less. And in the IT services, they meet this character who is made up of all bones, and he's like a shifting pile of bones.
Oh yeah, that guy. When you said our last adventure, I thought you meant like the last session, but you're talking about the last like full. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So John. That was that guy.
John. His name was Dear John.
So Dear John came about because I was like, what about uncomfortable questions? Like, how do I deal with like these ideas and these notions of like players coming apart? Because there's this notion, like, there's a very sad notion of, like, friends drifting apart. And you have friends, you have an adventure group that's, like, the same sort of thing. What about someone who can kind of get inside of that little comfortable bubble that they've built in their adventure and ask some questions that are uncomfortable because they're true? And that, I'll start with something like a concept like that, or I'll start with, like, a theme I want to explore. Like for Toby, it was like a hero that doesn't like, that's not very good at being a hero. And like, what does it mean to be a hero in that case? Like an idea like that. And then I just kind of take, like, I get very excited and I get very motivated to write from that place. And then I kind of imagine a scene. And this is the part that's really weird, where I just like, it just, like, kind of happens. Like, I don't know how to explain this. There's another TED Talk problem.
I love it.
Well, I mean, I think I asked a really obnoxious question, which is, like, asking a writer, like, where do you get your ideas?
It's cool. It's just, it's weird for me. Because it's, like, I very much subscribe to... I think there's different ways people are writers. And I think the way I write is kind of unusual in that, like, there's this The only other way I've heard it described is when people talk about muses and talking to your art and talking to, like, the thing as it exists outside of you, and then it, like, you are a vessel that channels it. So when I write, I feel not like I'm making the story. I feel like the story already exists and the characters already exist. I'm just channeling them through the ether. And, like, that's why when I'm, like, when you guys ask me, like, what's a room look like? Like, what does this room look like? I close my eyes and I, like, look around and stuff. It's, like, not just flavor text. So I'm, like, telling you what the room actually looks like.
Wow.
So the answer is I'm an insane
person. No, I love that. I love that idea.
Yeah.
That's like, just,
yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, sorry. I'm just, yeah, it's like, you know, other people like Tom Waits works the same way. The lady who did Eat, Pray, Love did this talk about that, I think, in the same podcast. It's a really good one. I think it's Me, Myself, and Muse is the name of the episode of the podcast that this was.
Oh, that's great. Check that out. We'll check that out. And listeners, you should check that out too. All I was going to say was like, yeah, I've thought about channeling worlds and how these worlds already exist and how also we just have a moral obligation to these worlds.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's like I started thinking about that when I was like really, really into like Grant Morrison's The Invisibles. And
I've never read it, but I've wanted to.
Oh, it's great. I hope it holds up. I haven't read it in like 20 years, but like also a lot of Grant Morrison stuff's like that Animal Man. There's like this, the world like grabs you and it's like the separation between reader and text like disappears. And I had that same feeling reading Jim Woodring's Frank, where it's like I had to put it down because I felt like I was entering into a nightmare reality.
Wow.
And like it was literally scaring me in a way that was like making me paranoid. But
I feel that some things are real in a way that you don't understand or like get. Some songs have that energy for me. Like I can't listen to them because I'm like, something wrong with this song. I don't.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something wrong with a lot of songs, but like some songs, I'm just like, it creeps me out. Don't know. There's something about it. There's something about it.
Yeah. When I'm like watching a movie or reading. Let's be honest, a comic book or something that like to make this like bad guy character like show how evil they are, they like kill 50 people or something. I'm like, this is like morally wrong that you did this.
Yeah.
As a writer.
Yeah.
This feels like you have a responsibility to this world that you created.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Coming from the other perspective, because I'm not a writer of creative fiction other than like a handful of like comedy sketches, but as a reader sometimes, or like a viewer of a movie, like, not that this is a novel thought, but like I'll get so invested, like I'll start sweating, you know, if like the main character's like near the bad guy and I'm like, I have to put the book down and be like, oh my God. And then I have to remind myself, like, this isn't real, but it's like, but it is real. It's really important to me that in this fictional universe that this main character gets out alive. And like, it's such a weird concept because I know they don't exist. And yet I will be disappointed if the words on the page are written in a way where this fictional world and this fictional character gets hurt. Like it's kind of bizarre when you think about it.
It's like, how do we get so invested in this made up stuff, but we really do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so powerful.
I wrote a manifesto, you know, like you do. but kind of about story in general and narrative.
Yeah.
And in it, I refer to characters as fictional persons.
Oh, I love that.
I kind of divide people into like it's fictional and non-fictional persons. And it's because, that feeling, like they're real. Like they may not be real in the sense of like, you know, flesh and blood or whatever, but they matter to you. They make an impact on your life.
Yeah.
Like, I did a whole talk when I was in my thesis year about, like, heroes and real heroes.
Mm.
And, like, when I was a kid, I had, like, this weird, like, kid brain, and I was, like, everyone was, like, this is my hero, this, like, baseball player, this is my hero, this, like, you know, other person in real life. So I thought you had to have real heroes that were like real people.
Mm.
Like my heroes were like Sailor Moon. Like she was my hero.
Right.
Mary from like Castlevania was my hero.
Right.
But I said my hero was like Tara Lipinski, and like no shade on Tara Lipinski, but like she wasn't my hero.
Right.
Like, I just said that because, you know, it felt weird to say a fictional person.
But
like I'm like 30 and Sailor Moon is like why I am the way that I am.
Mm.
Like she's way more real to me than Tara Lipinski.
Yeah.
Is.
Yeah. And you've probably like connected with her on a deeper level than Tara Lipinski, right? Tara Lipinski who is a figure skater for those that may not know. You know, she has a very curated brand, right? So you're only getting like this superficial version of her, whereas if you're reading about somebody's life and hearing their thoughts or watching them on a show, you're connecting with them on a much deeper level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
My hero is Spider-Man.
Right on.
I don't know who my hero is. Next week, I'll come with a hero.
Yeah, come with a hero. You best come with a hero. Come correct. Yeah, but man.
Oh my God.
I don't know. It's like a whole like Scott McCloud thing where like something iconic is easier to like relate to see yourself in. Like a cartoon, it's like so simple that you can, you know? I don't know. Like cartoons, when I was younger, like Disney movies, like Aladdin, I would always cry at the end of Aladdin. I still do.
Yeah, it's sad.
I cried in the middle of Aladdin.
When?
This is a weird one. And then please finish your story. During before Aladdin takes Jasmine on the magic carpet ride, they leave Raja the tiger.
They do.
And this tiger looks so sad to not get to go on the ride. And I remember seeing this in theaters when I was a child, and I just started bawling. And my mom was like, what's wrong? And I was like, they didn't take the tiger with them. And she was like, Ellen, you have so many feelings. It's so beautiful. Anyways.
This is my first time meeting you, Ellen, and I know that we're going to be good friends.
Likewise, I feel the same.
That's amazing. That's so like empathetic.
That's how I felt.
Very cute.
But continue. You were saying you cry at the end of Aladdin.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I probably cry a couple times during Aladdin. Not that part, although that's very reasonable to cry.
Look at that clip. It gets me every time.
But yeah, I cry at a lot of movies and I don't really cry in real life. Like nothing makes me cry in real life. But I cry at movies all the time. I watch movies with Robin, and I'm always like, sometimes I'll take, this is awful, it's weird, it's gross. Sometimes I'll take
bring it to
watching a movie, I'll take her hand and put it on my face so she can feel the tears.
Oh, I love it!
I do something way
she
grosser.
Always goes like, you're such a softie.
You're such a softie.
She never cries during movies. She's like a normal person. She cries in real at real things. And
interesting.
You said Keith is like that, Jenny?
Oh yeah, Keith is just like that too. He doesn't cry at real things, and he cries like during a lot of media in general. He's like very open about it, not ashamed of it or anything.
Yeah.
But I cry not often, but like when I do, it's often more at real things. But if a piece of media gets me, it fucking destroys me. Like Ted Lasso recently.
Oh yeah. Oh.
I was in the ground.
Yes.
I was
dead. That was one where where I cried. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're talking about the funeral episode?
No, the one before that.
Oh my god, wait, the Coach Beard beard after hours?
No, the one before that.
I know what you're talking about, where he reveals what happened to his father.
Oh, fuck me.
Yeah. And so I survive, like, the scene in the locker room.
Right. Oh
my god, brutal.
I survived all that, and I was, like, on the verge. I was, like, shaking. I was like, you can do it. You can make it. And then that scene outside, done.
Yeah.
Sobbing like a child. It was too much.
Mm-hmm. They pushed you over the edge.
Yeah. Oh my god. Me too.
They know they did that on purpose. They were like, we're going to get you all the way up and we're just going to push you over.
It was like a roller coaster. Me up sad.
What a beautiful show. Just beautifully written, yeah. Performed. Anyway. I know a couple people who don't like Ted Lasso. I don't get it.
Are they bad people?
They sound like bad people.
They're perfectly fine
people. No, they sound like bad people.
But they're not into it.
You know what I like about Ted Lasso? I know we're going long, but I'm not going to do anything to stop that.
That's okay.
What we'll I like about...
We'll cut this part out. Go ahead. I'm just joking.
No, I love that. That's so funny. No, go ahead. We'll cut it. Go ahead. We'll cut it. What I love about Ted Lasso is that, like, especially with comedies that I see on TV, there's a meanness to it. Like, that someone's a butt of the joke. It's really sarcastic. It's like, there's a lot of, like, shaming people. And so when I started watching Ted Lasso, I kept waiting for that. I was like, and it was just sweet. It was just gosh darn sweet. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is just a joyful, genuine show. There's not like a lot of irony in it. There's not a lot of sarcasm in it. It's just really genuine. How rude of you, Dennis.
Sorry, I should have turned off my
That's okay. And I'll say one more thing. I would love your thoughts on this as writers, because I'm in a book club with my family, and it's called Whatever Ellen Is Reading Right Now Book Club. They all read whatever book I've chosen, and then we talk about it.
Nice.
It's very,
very
sweet.
It's very sweet. But we've been reading a lot of sad books because... You know, I'll hear like, oh, this is a great book. Every book that's been recommended to me is usually sad, right? Like every like Nobel Prize winning book is a downer. And I kind of am, I think it's a bummer that as a society, we tend to value dark, sad things. And when something is just pure joy, we don't take it as seriously. We're like, well, this isn't award worthy, right? Like, why does it have to be painful and dark to be worthy of acclaim? Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, as a comedy person, I agree, but you're probably asking our guest.
But mostly, yes. Jenny, would love your thoughts.
Well, I would love to know your thoughts as well, Dennis, but I am answering right now, so that sounded so mean. That wasn't meant to be mean. That was like,
we only assume good intent from you, Jenny. That's the only assumptions being made.
That's right.
After I stop talking, I would love to hear your answer, Dennis, is what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think that that's because there's this really annoying and but really really long instated association between artists and suffering, and the idea of the tortured genius being a thing, that in order to be brilliant, you have to also be insane or sad or a lot of things. And I think that probably a lot of that comes from the fact that, like, a lot of what we consider genius in history has been, like, cis white men. So often, like, a lot of narcissists, you know, a lot of people with, like, undiagnosed mental disorder, but, like, they get to be on top and, like, oppress everyone around them, and that kind of power makes you go, like, it goes to your head. So unfortunately we have this like weird fake narrative that we've created of suffering equals artist and artist equals suffering. So I think when we introduce something funny, there's this haughtiness that like people get where they're like, oh, well, but it's not like, you know, that's not art. That's not,
right.
You know, it's like for children. Like
right.
Humor and right. levity is associated with children.
Yes.
And children's media can't be art. And I think, you know, I think that's also like, it probably honestly goes back even into like European paint, like painting traditions, like all this like crap. It's like just like very like in there. Like it's mm-hmm. just so in there, this idea of like art, serious.
Yeah. Yep.
Humor for like the poor people and for children. And like yeah. we and like so anything that's like, because I mean that's, it's true, you know, like when Shakespeare did funny plays or like had funny jokes, it was for like the dumb people who were poor or whatever in his audience, but like everyone liked it, but like that it was for the groundlings or something. So it's like, I think yeah, it's just all these like classist, like probably racist, sexist, ableist, like
right, right.
shit of art history that is like we still aren't reckoning with is to blame. I think, yeah, that is generally what I would say.
Yeah, that rings true for me. Mm-hmm. Dennis, absolutely. What do you think?
Yeah. I was just going to say, and my thing's not going to sound as good or deep as what you said, Jenny, but I just think, yeah, as a comedy person, it's like, this is also hard. This also takes brains, mm-hmm. a lot of brains. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being able to connect with somebody on a level of, like, you know, tickling their funny bone, that's got... It's important.
You think it's easier to make someone laugh or make someone cry?
That's the question. And people think it's easier to make someone laugh than cry. There's this really absurd, anyone can do it, how hard could it be?
Yeah.
Which is funny, because writing has, like, in general, such a low barrier of entry that, like, you know, everyone's like, how hard could it be? But then once they're in writing, they're like, well, humor, how hard could it be? Because drama's the serious thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, it's insanely hard to write comedy.
Yeah.
It's insane because you can just be funny. Like, I'm like with my friends funny.
Right, right.
But I don't think I'm like comedy writer funny. Like, I try really hard, but I'm like still not like there, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, and people like resent you if you're honest about that too. Like, I talked to this one kid once who like was making like a pilot for his thesis or something. And I straight up told him, I was like, get a comedy writer for your mentor. That's what you need to do. I know comedy writers and I can introduce you to them, but you really need a comedy writer for your mentor. And wouldn't you know it, he didn't take too kindly to that. He was like,
really?
Yeah, definitely. And like, I introduced him to somebody and like, he like just didn't call him back, kind of ghosted me in general. It was just like, I was like, oh, I guess men hate it when you say they're not funny.
Oh my god,
we could talk about that for another hour.
I know
I think we gotta
wrap up, which is so sad because this is so much fun.
I'm loving it too. Well, thank you so much. This has been absolutely such a joy. Another jewel we have so far. We're hitting. What's the expression?
We're batting 1,000.
1,000?
Is that none of us? Neither one of us are sports people.
No, we're asking each other like
batting 1,000.
Batting 1,000.
It's like
high.
Right. It's also like statistically impossible.
It can't be right. 1,000. I don't know. Well, listen, we did not do any of our segments because we had such a rollicking good time just talking, but that's okay. Jenny, is there anything you want to plug, anything you want to tell people about, maybe our D&D stream, Retrofuturish?
Yeah, great idea. There's Retrofuturish, which is at twitch.tv/retrofuture ished, that r-e-t-r-o FUTURISHED.
Boom.
That's how you spell it. And it's twitch.tv/that. Second to last Sunday of every month.
And archived on YouTube.com.
Yeah. They're also archived on YouTube. You could look up Retrofuturish. It's called Retrofuture-ish, but we have to use the ED on Twitch because I was creative, but not that creative.
Amazing.
Awesome. Yeah, so check that out. I also want to plug Retrofuture-ish. Which I am happy and lucky to be a part of. I play a Goliath who talks like Arnold Schwarzenegger, and it's very fun. I just had a thought the other day. I'm going to introduce you to the game, which is like, I have all these, like, clubs and maces and halberds and stuff. It's like, I want to get a gun. This world has guns. I should get a gun.
Yeah, the world has guns.
It'd be very useful. Anyway, we'll get into that at our next game. And what else? Saturday nights at the Magna Theater. Most Saturday nights, you can catch me at the Armando Diaz Experience.
Woo-hoo.
Yeah. Ellen, anything you want to plug? Anything you want to tell the people about?
Also, just plugging magnatheater.com. It's an improv and sketch comedy theater. Dennis and I are both teachers and performers there. So look at the show schedule and check us out.
Yeah. So magnatheater.com for all your improv needs. All right. Well, this has been great. Jenny, thank you again for coming.
Thank you.
Music is coming up right now.
Ooh.
And that's it for this week. Follow us on Instagram at Pursuit of Perfectness. Write us an email. We've got an email address, pursuitofperfectness@gmail.com. Thank you to Keith Bergen for our theme music. Thank you to me for our podcast art. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Until then, don't be so hard on yourself. Bye.
Bye.